are back in with another edition of our digital movie radio show and podcast. It is We've Seen That. I am your somewhat lucid host, TJ Reeves. He is my co-host, the famous Jay Betzel, who currently is crabby, grouchy, not happy because it's how many degrees and you're trapped inside right now in the wintertime?
First off, that is false advertising. I'm in a wonderful mood, but I am trapped inside because our wonderful weather people here for the predicted doom and gloom ice. They missed out on the ice, but it is 11 degrees, so
11.
I decided to just stay inside today here in Little Fort Worth, Texas.
Let's hear it for 11 degrees as I enjoy another afternoon in Florida where it's going to be in the upper 60s or the low 70s. This is why I live where I live in West Central Florida. This is why you choose to live in the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex.
So. Well, if y'all still had the Tampa Bay Bandits, maybe I could move out there and cover
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
You know, right now,
USFL.
I've got to stay where I've got a job, man.
You gotta do what you got to do. So anyway, this is our program. We're going to have a lot of fun today. You can follow us on Twitter at We've Seen That. You can also find us on Facebook at We've Seen That. Always follow him at the famous Jay for all these great movies and insight and this is a classic. We've done several classics on our previous shows. This one today is going to be a lot of fun because I think almost anybody that is listening to us knows something or all about this movie and the famous actors that are in it, Jay Betzel.
Well, yes, it's nominated for 7 Academy Awards.
Only 7?
Including Best Picture, and it won the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. Of course, we're talking about The Fugitive.
Oh, The Fugitive. Here we go.
I came home, there was a man in my house. He had an artificial arm.
Are you saying that I killed my wife? Are you saying that I crushed her skull? And that I shot her?
Ladies and gentlemen, listen up. We have a fugitive that's been on the run for 90 minutes. Average foot speed over uneven ground, barring injury, is 4 miles an hour. That will give you a radius of 6 miles. What I want out of each and every one of you is a hard target search of every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, or dog house in this area. Checkpoints will go up at 15 miles. Your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball. Go get him.
Oh, doesn't that just get you pumped to watch this movie? It's such a great movie. It was released back in August of 1993. It was number one at the box office, as you can imagine. And for the year, and actually worldwide, it grossed $368 million.
Hello.
How about that?
I think that gives you an idea of the popularity. And obviously, when you have a megastar like Harrison Ford involved, and then you have a... He's one of my favorite actors. I mean, I'm going to tell you up front that Tommy Lee Jones could read the Yellow Pages and I would watch probably for half an hour. So I'm totally in the camp of this movie just from having those two guys there. But when you combine all of the action and the chase scenes, you got to love this movie.
It's such an awesome movie. I know a lot of times when we do this show, I'll kind of mess around with you and just see if you can guess any of this box office. But this one, I'm just going to go straight ahead. 1993. The Fugitive finished number 3. The number 1 movie was Jurassic Park, which was the number 1 movie of all time until Titanic came out. Then we had Mrs. Doubtfire with Robin Williams. The Fugitive 3rd, followed by The Firm. It beat The Firm. Sleepless in Seattle, Indecent Proposal, the Robert Redford classic with Demi Moore, Woody Harrelson. In the Line of Fire with Clint Eastwood. The Pelican Brief. Schindler's List, which actually won Best Picture. and then one of Stallone's best movies ever, Cliffhanger. So basically, we can just do we've seen that on pretty much everything I just listed.
I think
1993 is a good year.
You're giving me all kinds of ideas now. At the time that we're doing this, we're in 2018, and so these are all 25th anniversary movies. But I love you kicking off with this one for so many different reasons. And look, I know we'll get into this a little bit later on, but the interesting thing that a lot of fans may not have been aware of is that the idea for this came from the very successful TV show, so they made it into the movie. I was not aware of the TV show. I was, you know, in the early 20s demographic, and I was enthralled with this movie. I don't know about you, but I saw this one in the theater, and I think I went and saw it a second time in the theater back in 1993. I don't know about you.
Yeah, and here's kind of the funny thing is when I saw it, you know, it came out, like I said, in August. It was towards the end of the summer, in a big summer. You know, we just mentioned some of the ones that came out that summer, The Firm, Sleepless in Seattle, Jurassic Park, Rising Sun, et cetera, all those that came out. And it was kind of one of those like, well, you know, I'll go see it because of who's in it. And I loved it so much. I saw this with the theater probably three or four times. And, you know, ironically, you know, like you say, it was based on TV series. It was from 63 to 67, I believe, is when it was on. And it had David Janssen playing Dr. Richard Kimble. And then after the success of this one, of The Fugitive, the movie, which, like I said, was, you know, nominated for all the Oscars, just had huge box office, they made another TV version of it with Tim Daly and Michael T. Williamson, who we know from Forrest Gump and Heat. He played the Marshal, and Tim Daly played Dr. Richard Kimble. And that was in 2000, 2001 on CBS.
How about that?
So they've gone back and done another TV version because, you know, Richard Kimble framed for the murder for his wife's murder by a mysterious one-armed man is just, it's, you know, it's awesome. You can't beat it. And you're talking about doing this movie. When we started doing this show last year, this was one of the ones that was a given that we were going to do. It was just a matter of finding the right time and a reason to do it. And basically the reason is that it's just so awesome, we couldn't wait any longer to do it.
I agree. And all due respect to the friends and family of David Janssen, who may find us and may be listening to this, or Tim Daly, who's been in some different things, including the television show Wings. Harrison Ford is Dr. Richard Kimble. I mean, beginning and end. You agree with me on that, right? Famous Jay, he's Dr. Richard Kimble for all
100%. You know, he's got so many iconic roles, obviously. We know Han Solo. We know Jack Ryan. We know Indiana Jones. Of course, he was in Blade Runner. I mean, I'm going to leave out something for sure, but he was, of course, presumed innocent. He played Rusty Savage, which is one of our favorite movies. You know, just there's a lot of things that you can kind of equate him with. But when you're going down his list of roles, this is certainly one of them. And we'll kind of go through the cast here in a minute. But one kind of fun little thing I was going to mention about him is his first movie. Do you have any idea what it was and when it was?
Harrison Ford's first movie?
Right.
This would have been pre-Star Wars. I remember George Lucas talking about seeing him in something, but I can't tell you without looking what it was. So hit me.
Well, I'll just throw it out. And this is one that this will be some fun trivia because I didn't know this until I looked it up, and I try to think I know a little bit about movies. 1966, it was called Dead Heat on a Merry-Go-Round, starred James Coburn, and Harrison Ford was in it as the bellhop pager.
Not exactly an earth-shattering role, but
it's
a credit.
There's no way you could have predicted when he was in that he was going to be the biggest box office star of all time.
Yeah.
And then he also was in American Graffiti in 1973 that George Lucas made. So that kind of handed
where
us.
Luca, there you go. That's where
right,
Lucas knew about
American
him.
American Graffiti to thank for Jack Ryan and Richard Kimble and Han Solo and Indiana Jones.
I like that. I like that. All right, so we have so much to discuss on that movie. Where do you want to begin? What do you want to do?
We are going to go through the cast, and obviously there's no need to really discuss Harrison Ford because we all know exactly who he is. So let's kind of look at the rest of the cast, and obviously Tommy Lee Jones he kind of dominates this movie. And part of what makes Harrison Ford so great is he's great in this movie, but he also kind of plays down in a way, you know, and lets Tommy Lee Jones kind of do his thing. And, you know, this is kind of – Tommy Lee Jones is obviously around before this. You know, the funny thing is for me, anyone who knows me very well, including you, sir, knows that Cheryl Ladd from Charlie's Angels is like my be-all and all.
I know.
You
know. I noticed
she's
that.
She's the greatest.
You on Twitter, yes. It's not hard to figure that
she's
out.
She's the best. You know, she lives just south of us down where I live, just south of me down in the Hill Country. She still appears in a few things here and there. But Tommy Lee Jones actually appeared in the Charlie's Angels pilot before Cheryl Ladd when Farrah Fawcett was there. He was in that in 1976.
Wow.
He was also in Coal Miner's Daughter in 80 with Sissy Spacek. That was a big one. a lot of people in Texas, especially, I don't know about the rest of the country, but Lonesome Dove, the miniseries, was a huge deal from Laramie Murphy. He played Woodrow Call. Then back going to 91, he was in JFK. Remember, he played Clay Shaw. Then Under Siege, he played Stranix. And Under Siege, he was great. Obviously, Steven Seagal's best movie.
Well, and you got to remember now in the chronology, I got to stop you here. In the chronology, you're talking about him being in JFK and then him being in Under Siege as the villain. I remember watching that one in the theater. And then he's now the law enforcement guy here as Samuel Gerard. He was red hot as an actor in and around this time frame 25 years ago. Yes, Tommy Lee Jones?
Yes, yes. And here's part of the reason. Under Siege was directed by the same man, Andrew Davis, who directed The Fugitive. So had we not had Steven Seagal's Under Siege, we may have had someone else playing Tommy Lee Jones's character here. May not have had this same amazing effect on this movie. So obviously The Fugitive, with him winning the Oscar, made him from an actor that people knew into a movie star. And then after that, he's made tons of movies. He's got The Client, you know, the John Grisham. He was in Batman Forever, the Men in Black series, No Country for Old Men. Most recently he was in Jason Bourne, that sequel there. And then don't forget, we'll talk about this a little bit later, but he also reprised this role in 1998 in U.S. Marshals. We'll get to that one a little bit later when we're discussing some of the trivia about this. Then moving on cast-wise, we also have Celia Ward, who played Helen Kimball, and just one of the most beautiful women ever. I mean, I'm surprised she wasn't a bigger star, because she's a good actress and she was awesome in this movie. And like, I was kind of looking back through some of her stuff to see what else I'd seen her in. The Man Who Loved Women with Burt Reynolds in 83. Did you ever see that?
I did see that one, yes.
Funny movie. Kim Basinger's in that. He's in that. Julie Andrews, I believe. Nothing in Common, 85, with Tom Hanks and Jackie Gleason. That kind of, you know, gave us first preview of Tom Hanks being a real actor.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's a more serious, more sad movie, yes.
Oh, and he was great in that. And then while The Fugitive was released, she was in the middle of her 5-year run as Teddy on the popular NBC show Sisters.
Oh, yeah. Sisters was always more big. Recently, and my wife was big into that. My mother's big into that. I'm a big Celia Ward fan, and I'm with you. It's unfortunate that for the plot to unfold, she has to meet her demise. She's not in the movie very much.
I know. I wish there was a way that they could have figured that out, where she could have come back to life or been in a coma or something. But, of course, they probably wouldn't have gotten for first-degree murder if she wasn't dead. So I digress.
Excellent point with you about the plot to the movie. Continue.
More recently, we've seen her in Independence Day Resurgence, and she was in Gone Girl, which is another fun movie. Moving on, Julianne Moore made an appearance in this. She was, like, listed fourth in the credits, but she's only in it for like 5 minutes. Once again, the little fun little facts we'll get to a little bit later in the show. She plays Dr. Anne Eastman, and when she was in this, she had just been in Hand That Rocks the Cradle, so people kind of knew she was kind of on the rise. Obviously, she stands out in this movie. She's got a screen presence to her. She followed this up with Assassins. You remember Assassins?
Yes, I do, very much. Stallone, Antonio Banderas, I've seen that one a bunch, and that was around the same time frame as Cliffhanger and a couple other ones that Stallone did, like post-Rockies, yes.
Yeah, remember he had that little run where he, I'm trying to think, he had The Specialist and Assassins, and I mean, like, pretty much every October, Demolition Man. It's like, October, you knew that he was going to to be in a big action movie. It was going to be number one. It probably wasn't going to be that good, you know, but it's just kind of one of those things where you knew he was going to come around. Anyway, she appeared in that. She was also in Jurassic Park's sequel, The Lost World. She was in The Big Lebowski. She appeared in Magnolia, which was one of Tom Cruise's greatest roles, big ensemble movie from 99. Then she's more recently been in the Hunger Games movies, The Kingsman, Golden Circle. I mean, are you a Julianne Moore fan?
I am, and wasn't she bigger on the HBO version of the Sarah Palin story, right? The Sarah Palin movie that they did on HBO, I believe that she was also with that. So she's got a wide variety of acting roles. And it's interesting, as you say, she's not in this one very much. It's a cameo, basically. She's only there for the couple scenes in the hospital where Dr. Kimball reemerges.
Right, yeah, she's in and out. She basically asks him to take the kid up to to one of the floors or whatever, and then it turns out he realizes something's wrong with him, and he basically orders an emergency surgery. So she goes after him and takes his ID, and he takes off, and then she's out of the movie. And of course, you know, Gerard's obviously flirting with her because she's a beautiful woman, but you know, she's an amazing actress. She's also an Oscar-winning actress. You know, so this was kind of one of the things that gave Julianne Moore the world. Dr. Ann Eastman was the role. So let's go on to Cosmo. Joe Pantoliano,
who I love.
He has 144 credits, so we're not going to go through all of them, but some of the highlights. This man has no problem getting jobs. Some of the highlights, you know, I think he started back in the early 70s, but I kind of know him from Risky Business and Eddie and the Cruisers in 83. Mm-hmm. Then Running Scared, he played Snake. Remember the movie with Billy Crystal and Gregory Hines?
Billy Crystal, Gregory Hines, the late Gregory Hines. Jimmy Smits is the bad
Run.
Guy. Right, right, right.
Right, Midnight Run. He plays Eddie Marscone, the bail bondsman, who basically calls Robert De Niro and John Ashton to go after Charles Grodin, which is one we'll definitely do in a future episode. The Bad Boys movies, the Will Smith, Martin Lawrence. He plays Captain Howard.
We know about him
he
as Captain Howard.
He is also in The Matrix.
Woo-sah. Yes.
Exactly right. And then, of course, he reprised his role.
Well, in The Matrix, he turns out to be a villain. Turns out to be part of the crew, but really a bad guy.
You know, and I may make some people mad about this, but I did not like The Matrix at all, and I did not even watch the two sequels.
Well, so not just some people. You're going to make me mad on that one because we got to do a – we've seen that at some point on The Matrix. Well,
we may need to bring Paul in on that one. And
could bring somebody else
voice.
In on that one. But, yeah, Pantoliano is in those. He's also famous, and I was not big into the series, but The Sopranos. He had a recurring role in The Sopranos for a lot of years, the popular HBO series, too. So, he's been all over the place. But I love him as Cosmo, as kind of the errands guy, the do-it-go-get-it-done guy for Gerard, for Tommy Lee Jones's character.
Yeah, well, you know what makes this movie is Tommy Lee Jones and his crew. You know, otherwise this would be just a guy on the run. But his crew and him, they have such a great interaction, and Joey Pants is one of the best ones. You know, he's so funny. He's like, why are you yelling at me? What did I do? You know, and he's just a really good character in this movie. And lastly, I'm just going to mention this just because it's our show and we get to do what we want. Ron Dean has a role in this as Detective Kelly, one of the cops who charges Harrison Ford. And the reason I mention this is he also appeared in The Breakfast Club as Andy's father.
That's right.
And remember that? And hey, guys, screw around. I screwed around.
Exactly. You got caught, sport. And so and he's in a couple of other ones. He's in Cocktail with Tom Cruise, playing Uncle Pat with the bar. He was also a cop in some other TV shows and movies, so you've known him.
He's been in pretty much every movie that Andrew Davis has made, like The Package, Steel Big, Steel Little, Chain Reaction, Briefs. Everything you see from Andrew Davis, who we are kind of segueing into, Ron Dean is obviously one of his boys, and he'll put him in. So Andrew Davis, the director of this, who did an amazing job. He's made plenty of other big movies, but like Code of Silence with Chuck Norris, he made that one. It's got a lot of the same characters in this and a lot of the same scenery. You know, the beautiful way that they portray Chicago in this, you know, from the skyline views and everything. It just makes downtown Chicago look amazing. You can tell, obviously, he's a fan of this city because it makes you want to go there just seeing the way they portray it. You got Under Siege. We've got The Package with Gene Hackman. Tommy Lee Jones is his. A Perfect Murder with Michael Douglas and Gwyneth Paltrow, or the remake of Dial In for Murder. Then he kind of hits a little patch with Steel Big, Steel Little, some not bigger movies. He had one with Collateral Damage with Arnold Schwarzenegger. Remember that one?
Mm-hmm.
Which was the terrorist movie that got delayed after 9/11, came out later on. Then kind of his last movie he's done, it's been about 12 years ago from when we're recording this, was The Guardian with Ashton Kutcher and Kevin Costner. Remember that one?
Yes.
Kind of had a little Top Gun meets
another great story.
Gentleman vibe.
love Kevin Costner's role in that one as really the flawed instructor, and Kutcher's the cocky kid. And back to A Perfect Murder, my wife and I still, that one's a good 20 years old. We watch that one all the time on cable, quote that one all the time, including one of the famous lines, "That's not happiness to see me." And then, of course, the other line is "Try surprise," because they're plotting against each other, and Michael Douglas is trying to kill his wife, and she figures it out with the whole "That's not happiness to see me" part of it. So, yeah, I mean, there's quite a cast, obviously, in this movie. There's no doubt.
Well, and then, lastly, I want to hit on, there's two screenwriters, David Tuohy and Jeb Stuart. Jeb Stuart, one of the screenwriters, he also did the screenplay for Die Hard. Another one.
I think that was one of our favorites. Yeah.
If you've listened to We've Seen That or whatever, even if you're just finding us now, we did We've Seen That episode on Die Hard a little while back. So you can go into our catalog on iTunes or Stitcher and go find it if you want to hear it. He also did another 48 Hours. So he did the sequel to Eddie Murphy and Nick Nolte's big 1982 hit.
Those are a couple of big screenplays, including this one. Yeah.
Yeah. And then one that he did that I really did not like was called Just Cause, that had Sean Connery. Did you ever see that one?
Who else is in it with Connery in that one?
Blair Underwood is in it. Kate Capshaw. It's Sean Connery getting this guy off because he thought that he was wrongfully accused. And Ed Harris is in it. Ed Harris basically playing his version of Hannibal Lecter. And it was one of those that could have been really good and was really not so great. So anyways, that kind of gives us the background and the stats on the movie. Do you want to talk about the movie?
Hey, you've given us enough on the cast. Why don't we talk about the movie?
Well, let's just dive right into it. So, you know, the opening credits, You know, like I was talking earlier, it's kind of throughout the movie, and especially the opening, it just has this amazing, you know, views of downtown Chicago from the side, from above, from in, everything. It's just, you know, awesome. And it kind of, you know, intertwines with the big, the party at the Four Seasons that Devlin McGregor's putting on, you know, for the deal with the hospital and everything. And Devlin McGregor, who we'll get to a lot later, is the pharmaceutical company kind of at the root of a lot of this. But while the credits are going on, it shows that they're at that party, kind of introduces some of the characters, Dr. Richard Kimball and his wife, Helen Kimball. Then it goes back to cutting through Dr. Kimball having to get called to go to the hospital. He gets home, finds a man in the house. He's killed his wife. The wife has called 911. The man that he kind of goes after him, he's a one-armed man, you know, and the guy ends up getting away because rather than chasing the guy, Dr. Kimball tries to go save his wife's life. And then, of course, it cuts to the interrogation scene. And let's talk about that for a second. What do you think about the cops in that and just the way they talk to him? And, I mean, I just – like, it's Rossetti and Kelly, who we see a lot. What do you think about those guys?
Well, just from the standpoint of – I think we've talked about this on a previous show, but maybe this is the first time that we've talked about it on the show. I can't recall. I have friends and relatives that are in law enforcement, including a father-in-law that was 25 years in the St. Petersburg, Florida Police Department in not only robbery, forgery, but robbery, homicide, and they would interrogate people all the time. So you always watch these things in Hollywood and see and – look, I mean, Hollywood's going to drum it up, and they're trying to get Dr. Kimball to confess, and one of the big things is they're trying to trip you up on inconsistencies and lies and things that you don't know. And then, of course, always in the Hollywood dramatics, Jay, that in the middle of the interrogation scene, they have to bring the key evidence that his fingerprints are all over the phone, or they're all, you know, they're all over her, you know, his skin is under her fingernails, all these different things that obviously point to guilt. And make no mistake, at the beginning of this movie, they're trying to speed along and get him into prison and set the whole movie into motion. Because unlike the TV show that lasted for, what, 4 years on the air and probably 50 or 60 episodes, we only got 2 hours. So we have to get him to trial. We have to get him on the bus and get him on the train tracks and have him escape. So you got to do that kind of quickly.
True. And, you know, the funny thing is within a year after this, we had the OJ trial.
Right.
You know, the subsequent, you know, murders of Nicole and Ron and the chase, quote unquote chase, during the NBA finals on Friday night, mm-hmm. which led to the house, you know, and then obviously, you know, Barry Sheck, Johnny Cochran, that whole crew and all the introduction of DNA evidence and everything. So something tells me that a doctor with all this money would have had a better lawyer, you know, had we have made this just a little bit later, and he would have gotten off on DNA evidence. First off,
you're trying to derail the plot of the movie. The plot of the movie is that he has to be wrongly convicted because that's what's going to make him a fugitive.
I'm just thinking out loud, because also I do think that if they remade this movie today with just the way society is, he probably would have done it. You know, we would have been rooting for him the whole time. It would have turned out he got away with it. You know, so, you know, I'm just saying. So I digress. So he's in jail. He gets on the bus, which looks like the crew from Con Air, the movie made a few years
very
later.
Very similar, yeah.
They're on this bus taking him to prison, and you've got Copeland, the guy sitting behind him. You've got another guy that kind of starts foaming at the mouth. They've obviously got this thing planned where they're going to try and escape. And but actually, I neglected to mention that he does get convicted, and he gets sentenced to death by lethal injection. So he's got that going for him. He's going, you know, he's on his way to prison, and these guys have their daring, you know, escape plan going. And he's kind of the beneficiary of that, if you will. But the bus rolls over after one of the guards tries to come help the guy, and the guy shanks him. The other guard shoots the guy and, you know, and then accidentally shoots the driver. So the bus rolls down the hill.
It's mayhem, right? I mean,
train tracks. Yeah.
You said earlier, like another 48 hours where the screenplay writer wrote this. It's not unlike the scene with Eddie Murphy in that movie earlier where the bus rolls over 17 times because there's biker gang members that are shooting at the bus. So we got a big time chaotic scene on the bus. The bus has a crash and the bus ends up on the train tracks. Yes.
Lands on the train tracks. And Kimball gets the guard to undo his handcuffs so that he can look at the guard that got
because he knows he's a doctor. Because he knows
because
he's a doctor.
He says, yeah, Kimball, help this guy. He's like, you got to unlock me. So Kimball throws the keys down on the ground. Copeland lets, you know, undoes his cuffs. Then they hear this the train coming in the distance. So, of course, the guard, you know, basically leaves all of them there. Kimball saves the other guard, you know, because that's just shows how he is. He's obviously, you know, a superhero and one of the greatest people to ever live. You know, that was so wrongly convicted of this murder. Copeland, of course, doesn't help him. He jumps out the back window. He gets off the bus just in time before it gets smashed by the tracks, or sorry, by the train on the tracks. And then the train derails and basically comes after him, you know. So he ends up jumping out of the way. And who of all people helps him but Copeland? Copeland comes over and gives him a hand and helps him up the side of the hill. And then basically tells him, you know, hey, you know, I don't care where you go, just don't follow me. So Copeland's gone. We think nothing else of him. Harrison Ford is off to, you know, running down the side of the river. And then 20 minutes into the movie, we get the introduction of Marshall Samuel Gerard and his crew. Talk about that a little bit. What do you think about them?
Well, I mean, they have to obviously show up here because what do we have? We have a fugitive. And so the U.S. Marshals are coming to find him and coming to try to track him down. And so we get introduced to him, and right away we can see who's in charge. I mean, they are...
He's a total badass.
They are clearly all going to follow Samuel Gerard, whether they think they are or not, including when he gets the sheriff in line.
Sheriff Rollins.
Sheriff Rollins gets him in line. PTA's on hold tonight. we're gonna take a look and go find this guy.
They're talking to the guard, and the guard tries to take credit for saving his partner, right? Which, of course, he didn't. And then he says everyone's dead.
And you know what Samuel Gerard says back? We're always fascinated at what? When we find leg irons with no legs in them.
Right. One of his guys, his guys had gone around surveying the scene. They came back with the empty leg irons. And he goes, do you wish to revise your statement?
Yes, exactly.
One of his people says,
we're always
like, what,
fascinated,
what?
Yes.
And he says, do you wish to revise your BS story, sir? And they show him the picture of Harrison Ford. Okay, he might have got out. And he's, oh! So then that's when we have the famous line about the hard target search and everything. And your fugitive's name is Dr. Richard Kimball.
And
go get him.
Go get him is the big thing. And that sets the whole movie into motion and the whole chase into motion. But yeah, I mean, look, there have been other portrayals of the United States Marshal Service. And full disclosure, I know a couple of United States Marshals. A lot of it is over-glorified by TV and Hollywood. But a lot of times, there are long days, long hours where you are following every lead possible to try to find somebody. And so there's some appreciation for the fact that they're on the trail, but they're not going to find him in 15 minutes. That's the whole thing with the movie. They're not going to find him right away. They got to chase him. They got to figure out where he might have gone, who's helping him, where is he hiding, and then eventually it all comes into motion and becomes clearer because as Gerard even says later in the movie, he's going to re-enter his life. He re-enters his life to prove his innocence. And so he ends up doing that.
He doesn't re-enter his life hanging out at the country clubs and the tennis clubs with Dr. Charles Nichols or anything. You know, he like is kind of on the DL. And basically what happens after this is he goes to the hospital. You know, he shaves his beard off. He steals an ambulance after he tells the guys what's wrong with that guy, the prison guard. You know, he randomly says, hey, tell him he's got an epiduncture or whatever, right?
He's got a puncture wound and needs a gastric procedure and something else.
Yeah, how do you tell that by looking at his face? So he does. He steals the ambulance. You know, the marshals get the word.
Our boy stole an ambulance.
They have the helicopter where they landed on the other side of the tunnel. You know, he does the tunnel chase where Tommy Lee Jones catches up to him.
Famous.
And what happens there?
Well, the best part of that one is they have the chase scene through the sewer, essentially, the feeders of the tunnel.
It's like a viaduct, kind of.
Yeah, and that are going to lead out to the overflow of water and into the river. And very famously, Tommy Lee Jones takes the wrong path and ends up losing his gun. And that's where Harrison Ford, where Kimball gets Gerard's gun and is now behind him. And here's another indication that he didn't do it because he has a chance right there to kill Gerard. And what does he say? Jay, very famously.
He says, I didn't kill my wife. And Gerard had with his hands up, I don't care.
I can see that right now, even though we can't see each other while we tape this. We've seen that. I can see him looking back with his hands up at him going, I don't care. He's just
Harrison
trying to
Ford.
Bring him in. He's not there to judge and preside over his innocence or his guilt. His job is to bring him in.
Yeah, and Harrison Ford, his character, Dr. Richard Kimball, has the chance to kill him right there. So if he is guilty, you know he would have popped him. OJ would have popped him if it was them. But he takes off, and then he gets out to where he runs out of room, and he basically looks at, what, 1,000 feet, several hundred feet drop at least.
Right.
And Gerard, of course, has another gun because he's a total badass marshal. He catches up to him, tells him to get down on his knees, put his hands behind his head, and he does a Peter Pan right off the side and down into the water.
I have a couple of interesting different anecdotes about those things. As I got a friend of mine that always quotes that part of the movie, including when somebody makes a dive and makes a wrong move and ends up splatting, and he says, he did a Peter Pan right here, right off of this ledge. And then there's another famous line that I often enjoy, and you and I quote lines to each other, and there are a lot of other people that remember lines. This one maybe not as famous, but I still love it nonetheless, where the one deputy is saying over the sound of the helicopter above him, when he's like, get the helicopter in here, he says, guys, there's no way he could survive that jump. The guy is fish food. And what does Gerard say back to him?
Says, go get a cane pole and catch
the fish that ate him. Then that's a beautiful.
When one of the other guys says, "Sam, there's no way he made it. He's dead." He goes, "That should make him easy to catch." And so Kimball obviously survives, as we know,
because it's Hollywood and it's right. Harrison Ford. Yeah, he has to survive because we got 45 more minutes of the movie.
Granted, he's a smart doctor, so he might have been able to put the math together and realize if he hit the water at a certain spot, he'd be okay. Even though it was obviously looked pretty cold too. Anyway, so he hitchhikes back to Chicago. We see him walking down the street. This lady picks him up. And then it cuts to a part where this is part of what makes this movie so great. It's so intense, is whenever you've got the marshals, they get the tip. Okay, she picked him up. They're at the house. Okay, tell him to sit on it. We'll be there first thing in the morning. And it turns out to be busting Copeland and not Kimball. You assume that they're going after, that they found Kimball. You know, they got a tip and they're going right after him. But it turns out it's Copeland. And so they go in, you know, and obviously it's the part where Copeland has the gun to his head.
The team goes in to make the arrest of the other fugitive, right, just so we clarify for that. Not correct. Everybody remembers all the names and who we're talking about, but they're going to they have located in the outskirts of Chicago one of the other fugitives, and they're going in to make the fugitive arrest with guns drawn.
Yeah, they what's his name? Cosmo's cousin or brother has like a repair truck. So they pull up and they all look like they're just downtrodden, and they end up going in and busting through early in the morning, knowing that Copeland and his girl are going to probably still be asleep. And Copeland jumps up and he grabs Newman and has a gun to his head, and Gerard jumps around the corner and shoots him in the head and
saves his guy's life. Yes,
basically. Newman, of course, you know, he's like, I'm gonna have permanent hearing damage, and he's like, you think I should have bargained with him? And he's like, yes, I do. He whispers to a guy who has permanent hearing damage, I don't bargain.
That's exactly
which
right,
which sets up Tommy Lee Jones's character, just so you know, that there's no chance he's going to bargain with Harrison Ford. He is a, you know, hardline guy, and that's how he is. So then it cuts to Harrison Ford calling his lawyer from a payphone that says Illinois Bell next to the elevated train, and tells him he's in St. Louis because his lawyer wants him to come in. And then it goes to the fact that the marshals have his lawyer's phone bugged. And, you know, and back then, this is pre-enemy of the state, so we don't know all this stuff. But this is pretty cool how they're listening to all this. And they've got they play it back. And, of course, one of the guys says, oh, that sounds like an elevated train. I used to live under one. And Tommy Lee Jones is like,
I want to hear the sound of an elevated train. Yes.
Yeah, what's the difference between a train that runs on the ground and runs in, you know, and then so they hear the announcement in the background. Tommy Lee Jones does, while the other guys are kind of listing off, oh, who's got an L? New York, we do, Milwaukee. And he says, okay, can you go to that one part where he says next stop something, and yep. So they hear it, and it's 6 blocks away. He's like, our boy has come home.
He did come home. Now my question to you, while we stop for a moment talking about the fugitive, shoot, have you been to Chicago, and or have you ever ridden on an elevated train?
I have ridden on an elevated train when I was in New York, when we went to Yankee Stadium and we went to go see the U.S. Open tennis, but I've never been to Chicago, and I really want to go. And I really want to go in the summer because I don't like winter, as I'm dealing with right now. I'd like to go sometime and see a Cubs game, and eventually I will someday. I mean, like seeing like my best friend's wedding when they're on the mm-hmm. water riding around, seeing this movie, you know, just some of these Chicago movies, just they make me want to go and visit the city. But no, sir, I've never been.
Well, I can tell you two or three different things about this. Number one, I've been to Chicago. I've ridden on the elevated train in and around Chicago and out to the outskirts. The train is usually very inexpensive, probably a couple dollars you can ride into the city, a couple dollars more you can ride back out of the city. It's certainly less expensive. I remember we took a cab ride to the northern suburbs. This is before Uber, before Lyft, and all the things we have now in 2018 when we're making this. Cab ride out of the city was like $57 to get where we're going, up the interstate and out and about. Train ride back in was like $275. Through a couple of stops, much nice. More cost-effective to be on the elevated train. I can also tell you this from having been in Chicago just before this movie was made. What was this? This was filmed probably 91, 92 and released
It was filmed in the spring of 93. They made it
that
quick.
Wow, that quick in the spring of 93. I can tell you that in the winter of 91 and 92, I was in Chicago two different times. And in the winter of 92, I was there in March. And I was there at the time where they dyed the Chicago River green for St. Patrick's Day, like you see in the movie for the St. Patrick's Day parade, where Harrison Ford is running through the plaza and running through the parade, and the river is green. I've been there in Chicago when it's been green. They do that traditionally, I think, for the whole month of March, or at least for the beginning of March leading up to St. Patrick's Day. So it's pretty cool to see that in the movie, having been on an elevated train, been to Chicago, seen the green river, and there you see it in the movie whenever you see The Fugitive.
That's awesome. And when I go to Chicago, as I said, I will go someday. I'm definitely going to kind of take note of some of these things. So moving on, just some of the housekeeping stuff. He goes and sees Dr. Nichols at the tennis club, which kind of reminds you who he is, because, you know, you saw him at the very beginning of the movie during the opening credits when he gives Richard his keys and says, thanks for loaning me your car. Then the marshals go to talk to Detective Kelly and Rossetti and kind of figure out what's going on, and basically decide to go re-interview everyone from the case. Kimball rents the downstairs apartment with the Polish family. You know, Detective Kelly has a meeting with all the police where he says he's going to donate a 12-year-old bottle of scotch to anyone who can find this scumbag Kimball. Then Kimball starts going to Cook County Hospital, the prosthetics unit, start trying to do some investigation, see if he can figure out who this one-armed guy is. You know, and then Gerard goes and interviews Dr. Nichols. He and Cosmo do. And Nichols says that Richard is innocent. Right. And he says it so profoundly, like he knows he's innocent, you know. And then he also says they'll never find him because he is too smart. And they say, what about us? We're pretty smart. Is he smarter than you, or is he smart as you? And Nichols says he's smarter than I am. So that just kind of tells you that conversation, which is kind of seems like a throwaway. It kind of tells you a lot of what you need to know. Then, you know, they do the investigation. You know, they start talking to everyone. You know, Kimball does. He's looking for the killer. You know, the cops. Then here's another part. Once again, we talk about how intense this movie was. You know, Kimball's living basically in the basement of this house, which is not the nicest neighborhood in Chicago. And he hears all these sirens, all these cops pulling up. They show up, and you're like, oh, God, they found him. And it turns out they're arresting his landlord's son for dealing drugs to 12-year-old kids. You know, and this kind of an overweight guy with long hair, looks like he hadn't bathed in a month, just looks like a total scumbag. Anyways, so while Kimball is at Cook County Hospital kind of just hanging out, Julianne Moore makes her appearance about an hour and 10 minutes into the movie and asks him to take the kid up to observation room number 2. And of course, you know, as he's walking off, Kimball starts looking at the film and he orders this emergency surgery that saves the kid's life. And she sees that as he's walking off. And in the meantime, the marshals, you know, Detective Kelly has interviewed this guy, the son of his landlady who was arrested for dealing drugs. And Detective Kelly finds out because he says, hey, that guy is staying at my mom's house. So the marshals are going through Dr. Kimball's room. He's eating oranges and making IDs.
Well, the first thing is they show up guns drawn because just like with the previous one with Rollins, they're not sure if they're going to catch him there or not. They kick the door in, come looking around, you know, total Hollywood search team style. And then they realize he's not there, and I love that line from Tommy Lee Jones. Oh, look here. We're eating oranges and making fake IDs to go back to Cook County Hospital.
Yeah, so while they're doing that is why he's saving this kid's life and orders this emergency surgery. And then in the meantime, he's walking down the hallway, and Julianne Moore has gone to observation room 2, can't find the kid, finds out that, you know, the kid's on the fourth level or whatever. And so she ends up confronting him and saying, you know, do you have a certain interest in our patient's x-rays? And he says, oh, it's a hobby of mine. And she's like, what's your other hobbies? Brain surgery? And he's like, I'll just do what I'm told. And she grabs his ID and says, you know, you hold it right there. Of course, he takes off running. And then Gerard and Cosmo show up to the hospital because they get the call, obviously. And Gerard's talking to Julianne Moore's character, Dr. Eastman. He's like, so a guy orders an emergency medical procedure and you just grab his ID and tell him not to go anywhere. And she's like, what was I supposed to do? I called security. And he's like, well, so what happened to the boy? And she's like, oh, he saved his life. And he's just sitting there smiling at this beautiful woman. She's finally like, can I go home? I'm tired. And he's like, yeah, sure. So in the meantime,
you pass that off for a second. But I think judging by everything that's transpired to that point, it is really starting to occur to Gerard. He's not behaving like a suspect who's guilty and who's on the run. He's behaving like somebody who is either innocent or believes he's innocent and is trying to prove his innocence. And I think standing there, he's looking at that fake ID Don't you? He's looking at Julianne Moore, and now it's starting to all come together for him that this guy is taking unnecessary risks coming back to the hospital, coming back to his life, because he's trying to prove something. He's trying to prove he didn't do it.
What happens next? Because Cosmos says, why would this guy come to this hospital crawling with cops
right.
and play Good Samaritan? And then they get bumped into by a guy with one arm. And so they both kind of look at each other and smile, and they follow him to the prosthetics unit, where they start doing basically the same, you know, tests that Harrison Ford did. And they start going, okay, you know, the right arm, you know, cross-check it for this, cross-reference it for this. And while they're doing this, Kimball's at a payphone calling these guys because while he was in the prosthetics unit, he had made himself a little list of the guys could possibly be, and he narrowed it down to five. And so they cross-check it for criminal records, and it happens to be Clive Driscoll, who you've got Harrison Ford has called and found out, oh, one-armed man, armed robbery, okay. So he goes to the county jail of all places. Now, granted, he's dyed his hair black. He has no beard, but, I mean, obviously, you know, we don't have the internet back then, so we didn't have guys pulling out their phone, looking at Twitter, trying to figure out if this is the guy. But everyone looks at him, you know, whether it's the guy in the hospital that sees him and tells him to zip his zipper up, or the guy at the jail that looks at him, you know, that guy looks so familiar. I wonder if I've seen him. You know, it's like they're the worst cops ever. But either way, so then he goes to the jail to go visit Clive Driscoll to see if it's him. In the meantime, the marshals had cross-checked it for criminal records, so they're on their way to the jail. And this is where we have the part where you mentioned about the St. Patrick's Day River being dyed green,
mm-hmm.
where Biggs asked him if they can dye it green today, why can't they dye it blue the other 364 days?
Right.
And then he says something along the lines of about it's hinky. That Kimball's gone, but he wouldn't be going here. And he's like, what does that mean? He goes, you know, strange. He says, why don't you say strange? Don't say words that have no meaning around me. And he gets mad at him and goes and takes the stairs. And then as he's going upstairs, Kimball is leaving, seeing Clive Driscoll. He's going down the stairs. And out of the corner of his eye, he sees him going down, runs across the lobby, goes down, sees him, yells his name, says, Richard. He looks up, and then the chase ensues, which ends up with Kimball out running through the plaza and out into the St. Patrick's Day parade. And getting away from everyone and, you know, and the marshals and this and that. And all of them are just kind of looking around like, how do we lose this guy? We had a guy on the roof watching him and everything. So, obviously, you know, they had been pretty careful to not let it get out to the press because, as you mentioned, they wanted him to kind of reestablish himself. And so now with the going through the parade and everything, it's all out. And he's having a press conference with Rossetti, Kelly, and Gerard. And basically, and Gerard does his best Bill Belichick impression. You know, he's like, I can't comment on that. I don't know anything about that. You know, I think the only time he answers is when a guy goes through the thing. He's like, he was convicted of murder, incarcerated, escaped, presumed dead, is now on the run. He goes, well, I'll accept the part about being presumed dead.
Because he never presumed him dead.
Exactly, because he never thought he was dead. That was Sheriff Rollins. So anyways, then, you know, through all this, Kimball goes to one of the guys on his list, which is Frederick Sykes. He goes to his house, and they've got cops sitting out front because they had obviously found Sykes through their research as well. So he sneaks around the back, goes into Sykes' house. You know, sees his picture. He knows it's him because he's obviously seen the guy. And he calls the marshal's office and then kind of, what do you think about that part? When they're like, oh, we got another Richard Kimball. And, you know, so Tommy Lee Jones gets on the phone. Yeah, this is Gerard.
And, of course, he's going to.
And it goes from there.
He obviously is not suspecting what he's going to hear. Which what is it that he hears on the other end from Kimball?
He's like, do you remember what when I saw you in the tunnel? You know, and he's like, I, you know, remember
do
what you
remember
said?
Like, I remember what I said to you in the tunnel,
yeah.
Right?
And he goes, yeah. And he's like, I remember you're pointing my gun at me. And, you know, and of course, all the guys are joking around laughing. And Tommy Lee Jones jumps up, starts waving his hands. They start, you know, recording it, start doing the trace and everything. And Harrison Ford wants them to know where he is because he wants them to find this guy. So he leaves the phone off the hook. You know, he leaves the photo out that has Alec Lentz. So, you know, Gerard and the marshals group, they all go there, you know, to Sykes' house. And Sykes arrives, and he's like, what is this, a trench coat commission? Like, well, how does everybody know me? What's going on here? And they said, there's a break-in, Mr. Sykes. He's my place, the place above. Oh, it was in your place. And so he goes in and basically tells him he has no idea who Richard Kimball is. He's like, oh, yeah, the guy that killed his wife. Yeah, I remember him, whatever. And then from there, when they're leaving, Gerard tells Cosmo, he's like, this guy's dirty. So Gerard knows that Kimball, he knows he's innocent.
He's basically solving the murder for them, for the police and for the marshals.
He's one step ahead of everybody because, like Dr. Nichols said, he's smarter. So Kimball calls Dr. Nichols at the Chicago Hilton where they're doing this big Devlin McGregor thing, right? Calls him and says, you know, hey, get – I know who it was. I know it was Lentz. And Nichols tells him, hey, Lentz is dead. you know, and Kimball just is deflated because he knew he'd figured it out. And Lentz was one of the guys that was part of Devlin McGregor that we met at the beginning of the movie, kind of in passing. And Devlin McGregor, as we come to find out, has this drug, RDU-90, called Provasic. And Kimball knew that it wasn't going to work, but they were falsifying the research because we're talking about, you know, obviously on this, hundreds of millions of dollars at stake, because as Gerard points out, the company Devlin McGregor made $7.5 billion alone the year before. So that company is a monster, and he wants to know why he decided to be a cop instead of going and being a doctor.
Something that we often ask ourselves about other professions, including doing radio shows instead of going into the pharmaceutical industry. But yeah, so now, I mean, the pieces are all coming into place, and the motive here for Lentz being gone is Lentz knows too much. He's expendable. He perhaps could talk. He could talk to the FDA. He could talk to the feds, the cops, whoever. So at this point, he's a loose end, and that's why he ends up being bumped off, being killed.
Right, because obviously the plan was to kill Richard Kimball and his wife because they could squash this deal because Kimball knew. So then you've got, you know, while during the conversation that Kimball has with Dr. Charles Nichols, he asks him, he's like, hey, call Bones, who's one of the, you know, one of the guys in the lab at Chicago Memorial, and tell him to get me to help me with the tissue samples and get me whatever I need. And Dr. Nichols complies, which my first thought when I saw it was, why would he help this guy if he did it? But he complies because he calls Sykes and says, here's where Kimball's going to be. Go get him. You know, kill him. He's out. And so that way he knows where Kimball will be, because this whole time he hadn't known where he is either. You know, he keeps offering to help him. Oh, let me help you. Let me do this, because so he can kill him. You know, but the whole thing is Kimball's too fast and too smart for everybody.
Exactly.
So Kimball, while he's at Chicago Memorial, he's talking to Bones. Bones even says, you know, what happened to that thing with your wife? You know, and you can tell Bones is kind of, you know, little out there, but he's a nice guy.
Great line.
And he says, it's not over yet.
Exactly.
Yeah, and basically, you know, it's still going on, but we're on our way. So he goes in to one of the research doctors, which is another lady that is one of the ladies that was interviewed by the marshals earlier, who said, I believe him to be innocent. And they said, well, have you helped him? And she's like, he hadn't contacted me. That's not his style. But if he did, I would. So he goes in. She helps him. They look at the tissue samples, realize that they've been changed. He looks at all of it, and they were all basically signed the day that Lentz died. So he kind of puts two and two together, realizes the only other person that has the access to do that would be Dr. Charles Nichols.
Mm-hmm. And now we know.
And exactly. This amazing movie, this well-written, you know, beautifully filmed, perfectly acted movie, this gigantic jigsaw puzzle is all kind of coming together, you know. And the obvious is that the phone records that they do with Sykes have Kimball calling Sykes, and the marshals are talking about this. Kimball called Sykes. Sykes basically said he didn't know who Kimball was, and it turns out, because as we know from the beginning, if you're paying attention, Charles Nichols borrowed Dr. Kimball's car and called Sykes from Kimball's car. So it all kind of starts making sense. Kimball's taking the L to go to the Chicago Hilton so he can go confront Charles Nichols. While he's on the L, who do we see?
Sykes.
And the funny part is, you know, there's a guy sitting there on the train looking through the newspaper, and there's a big picture of the wanted Kimball. So he sees him. He tries to be nonchalant. I don't know what I would do in this situation. I would probably go, God. You know, of course, now you could just text somebody or whatever.
Right.
But, you know, at that time, so he gets up and he goes to the car next door where there's a train cop. And in the meantime, Sykes gets up. He and Harrison Ford are having words. And the cop comes on, and Sykes turns around and shoots the cop. So, of course, Chicago PD, who already hates Kimball, thinks Kimball killed this cop on the train, right? So Kimball ends up, you know, ironically, beating up the guy with one arm, and he handcuffs him to the pole on the train. Gets off the Chicago Hilton, walks in, you know, walks right through the lobby, gets on the elevator, and goes up into this huge ballroom full of all these people that know him, because they're all the medical community of Chicago, where Dr. Charles Nichols is getting a big award from Devlin McGregor, and I believe they're naming him to the board or something. And so he's making a speech, and he sees Richard in the back. He says something about the drug was developed in cooperation, not competition, with Chicago Memorial, and looks forward to a continued honest partnership, and Kimball walks up and just calls him out in front of everybody.
He's like,
you falsified your research, didn't you? You changed the samples, isn't that? And, you know, he tries to kind of play it off. He's smiling. He's like, you know, ladies and gentlemen, my friend Richard Kimball's not feeling well. So, Richard, you want to speak for a second? He's like, I'll be back in just a second. So then Richard Kimball goes up and he says, he's like, what, you kill Lentz? And just shoves him. And then, you know, everybody's, oh, you know, they all watch. Oh, my God. In some, like, social setting, of course. And then the guy says, can we get some security up here? And in the meantime, they figure out, you know, the marshals figure out where he's going because they hear about the over the radio, they hear about the cop getting killed on the L, and they hear about the disturbance at the Hilton. So the marshals show up, you know, and knowing damn well that Kimball's innocent and the cops are there and they're going to get him. You know, because they have.
So I mean, it's basically it's a race. It's a race to whether they can now, ironically, not just bring him in to bring him to justice, but bring him in to save him before the Chicago PD kills him.
Yeah. So
or before Nichols kills him, right?
Yeah. You got Nichols trying to kill him. They're up there on the roof fighting. You've got Chicago PD with the helicopter.
We
got
to be honest here for a second. All right. I mean, you can try to dumb down Harrison Ford. But that's Indiana Jones. That's Han Solo. That's Jack Ryan. Nichols, the actor, is not going to take down Harrison Ford, Richard Kimball. That is just not going to happen. When they're having the fight the whole time in the theater, I knew he's not going to beat up Indiana Jones or Han Solo. Come on.
Well, I don't know how to pronounce his name perfectly. We'll just say like Jerron Crabb or something. Right, the guy that played Charles Nichols. He's a little bit bigger than Harrison Ford, and he's obviously crazy.
But come on.
You know, the way the world works, crazy sometimes beats, you know, stronger or whatever. So we'll see. But anyways, they end up getting this fight on the roof. You've got Chicago PD with the helicopter above him with spotlight on. They're shooting at him. And Gerard calls Newman and says, get them to quit shooting because I don't want to get shot. You know, and he's up there too. And right when he comes around the corner, Harrison Ford dives on top of Charles Nichols and they fall through this glass partition and on top of an elevator, right? So the elevator starts going down and then and Tommy Lee Jones and Gerard stand there watching him. Cosmo runs up. He's like, no, wait. And Cosmo says, doesn't this guy ever stop? And he's like, no, let's find out where that elevator's going, you know, because obviously Tommy Lee Jones never stops either, you know, so they're like the perfect match. So they call Newman. Newman says the elevator stops on the fifth floor, which is the laundry level. So they're on the laundry level. And Charles Nichols gets up, and he's actually on the bottom of the elevator, and Kimball's on kind of the roof because Charles Nichols fell all the way through. So Kimball ends up getting just in time before the door closes and keeps hunting Charles Nichols down. Then Gerard gets there. He shows up with his team. You know, the rest of his guys get all the laundry people out there to make sure they're safe, and Cosmo and Gerard start going to look for Dr. Charles Nichols and Kimball. And Gerard basically starts, he's like, look, Dr. Richard Kimball, I know you're innocent. I know about Charles Nichols. I know about Frederick Sykes. I know that he borrowed your car, no forced entry. And, you know, so Kimball starts smiling. He's like, I got it. And then he sees, you know, because Gerard's just yelling. He's walking, you know, he's walking around yelling. And then he sees Charles Nichols is about to shoot Gerard. So, you know, he's panicked. He's like, the one guy that knows I'm innocent is about to get killed. So he just takes him out. He basically Tonya Hardings him and hits him in the back of the knees. And when he's going down, he hits him in the back of the head. And Gerard walks over, and he's like, that guy killed my wife. And he's like, I know it, Richard. I know it.
Yep.
And that's kind of the apex. You know, he walks out of the Hilton, you know, through all the press corps and through all the police and takes him out. You know, they've got the one-armed man in custody. You know, the cops are – or sorry, the press is actually calling Detective Kelly and Rossetti out. Is it possible he made a mistake? And, like, you know, before they're like, he's guilty. He did it. And now they're like, I don't know. You know, so he walks him out. They get in the car, drive off, the end.
Well, and – again, the story wraps in a 2-hour setting because, as we referenced earlier in the show, it goes on for 4 years on the television series where he's trying to prove his innocence week after week after week on the series and make his way back. And so, you knew the movie was going to have the climactic end. I was wondering, you know, what's going to happen to Gerard? Is Nichols going to kill him by accident? One of those things. Again, the whole time that I'm in the theater, I remember this. Even now, 20 plus years later, I remember sitting there. That's Indiana Jones. Nichols, that character is not going to capture, kill, injure Kimball, Harrison Ford. It's not going to happen. But I wasn't sure what was going to happen to Tommy Lee Jones or Gerard. I don't know what you thought during that whole climactic chase scene or what was going to happen, because Hollywood's full of surprises and swerves and surprise moves. So I wasn't sure.
I thought he'd be fine. I mean, he might have gotten shot. I really thought Cosmo was dead when that pole hit him. You know, right. I thought he was toast. Well, so we've kind of gone through the movie. We did this a little different. We kind of did a play-by-play of this one just because this is such an awesome movie, and there's so many twists and turns. If we didn't, like, literally go through it, we would have totally missed some stuff, and we probably did anyways because it's just that kind of movie. But let's hit some of the fun facts. We've got I did so much research on this, I've probably got too much, so I'll try and hit some of the highlights. About Harrison
Lay some
Ford,
things he, on me. All right, go.
Yeah, he damaged some ligaments in his leg during the filming of the scenes in the woods, and he refused to do surgery so that his character would keep that limp.
Right.
And that limp was in every subsequent scene when you see him running, right?
Right.
So that's something kind of cool. Okay, the wrecked, the train and the bus is a tourist attraction where it was filmed, and it was not in Chicago. It was in Dillsboro, North Carolina.
You got to love that. So, I've never been to Dillsboro, but it definitely has the feel of the mountains of Tennessee, of North Carolina, of Virginia, of that part of the country. So when you say that, that's believable that it could be in that kind of setting.
Exactly. 100%. I mean, and then that scene was just so awesome, especially back then. You know what I mean? Without all the CGI and stuff we have now. So here's what we got. Julianne Moore, we mentioned she was listed really high in the cast, and she seemed like she would have a bigger part for that. Turns out she originally had a bigger role in the film, even after she exposes Harrison Ford's character, and that Kimball actually sought her out for help afterwards, and he eventually fell in love with her. The scenes were filmed and deleted from the final cut because of the fact that it would have messed up the story with him being so obsessed with finding out who killed his wife that he moved on to someone else.
So really, the writers and the filmmakers wanted Gerard to have a humanistic side and even have a love life at the end.
Kimball fell in love with Julianne Moore, not Gerard.
All right, so I'm thoroughly confused now. So Kimball,
let me read it again.
Kimball not only renders his life to prove his innocence, but now is going to find love again through the hospital. I got you.
Right, I'm going to read this. Her character had a bigger role after she exposed Kimball. He sought her out afterwards, asking for help, and eventually fell in love with her. So that's it.
But it's all. But
those scenes
floor.
Are in the they're in the DVD. You can find the deleted scenes. They're
interesting.
There. So. Here's one that goes back to what we were just talking about. The character of Cosmo Renfro was actually supposed to die in that finale. However, Joe Pantoliano successfully lobbied for his character to be spared so that he could possibly appear in a potential sequel, which he did in U.S. Marshals.
Yes, very good. Good strategy from the agent, too, to convince the screenwriters to keep you open-ended.
Exactly. And here's another one. Speaking of love interest for Dr. Kimball's character, Dr. Kathy Whalen, played by Jane Lynch.
Yep.
You know, the one we talked about, the research character. She was also considered as a love interest, but they decided to keep it platonic as it would have looked bad for him to take a new lover while avenging the death of his wife.
But once his innocence is proven, then all bets are off, and maybe he comes back to whatever doctor that he wants and however that works. All right, what else? Anything else?
And also, yeah, plenty more. Richard Jordan, who we know from like The Hunt for Red October, A Secret of My Success, he played Uncle Howard. He was originally cast as Dr. Charles Nichols. He actually filmed some scenes, but he became ill and he had to drop out the picture. So there's a part when they had Jerome Crabb, they had to go reshoot some of those scenes. And if you look closely, whenever the part at the tennis club, Harrison Ford's beard looks different because he had to regrow it for the reshoot.
How about that? All right. So that's something else to watch for. And unfortunately, Richard Jordan passed away shortly after the film was released, right?
So, right. Like 3 weeks after the movie came out is when he passed away.
How about that?
So, yeah, and as I said, they were filming this in the spring of 93. So we're talking 6-7 months after that, he was, and, you know, he'd passed on to the next plane. So here's one that pretty much I think everyone knows that knows anything about The Fugitive, that Alec Baldwin was originally cast to play Dr. Richard Kimball.
How about that?
But due to some creative differences, they moved on to Harrison Ford. And this is the second time that Harrison Ford has taken over a role that was Alec Baldwin's, because Alec Baldwin played Jack Ryan in The Hunt for October and then did not reprise the role of Patriot Games, so they replaced him with Harrison Ford. So we have Alec Baldwin to thank for Dr. Richard Kimball and Jack Ryan being Harrison Ford.
I think he's much better as Jack Ryan. I think he's much better as Richard Kimball in this. I think it worked out well for Harrison Ford. Alec Baldwin, you snooze, you lose.
I agree. You know, and the funny thing is you look at some of Alec Baldwin's movies, and he's got some good movies, but how much different would his career have been, you know?
Well, I saw another actor that was being considered, too, was Michael Douglas, maybe, for this. And Douglas is known more for some of the dramatic movies, you know, we've talked about here and there, like Fatal Attraction being one of those, or Wall Street, where he's Gordon Gekko. He does do kind of an action movie with stunts in The Game later in the 90s with Sean Penn, where they're playing the ridiculous high-priced life-and-death game and tricking him the whole time. But, I don't think Michael Douglas works as well as – maybe it's just because Harrison Ford's such a great action actor that it would not have worked as well. Your take on that?
Yeah, I think of Michael Douglas as the cool guy from like Wall Street and Perfect Murder and The Game. You know, I mean, he's so good at playing, you know, that part, the cool guy. And Dr. Richard Kimball's like a real person, you know, and Harrison Ford has that everyman quality to him, even though he plays all the, you know, Han Solo and Indiana Jones. He comes across as a guy that you could be sitting next to at a restaurant, not thinking anything of it. So I agree,
of course,
definitely better.
And, you know, there's so many different roles in movies, but, you know, we talked about in Basic Instinct, which was around the same time frame where Douglas is the cop and is chasing Sharon Stone and doing his different stunts and doing his different things. So he's obviously a diverse, broad actor that can play many different roles. I just don't think he would have been as good as the fugitive in this instance. Maybe it's just because Harrison Ford's just that good in this role that nobody else really would have compared, I don't think.
No, I agree. I mean, you know, like I said, it's one of those things. They made the right call.
They absolutely did. Box office agreed. What about the critics? Did the critics agree at the time?
Let's look at what we have from Mr. Roger Ebert. 4 stars for The Fugitive. The Fugitive is one of the best entertainments of the year, a tense, taut, and expert thriller that becomes something more than that, an allegory about an innocent man in a world prepared to crush him.
So he liked it. So he liked it, and he got it right.
He loved it. Let's see. I got a couple others here. Let me find where I've got it on my little page here. Okay, we've got the Washington Post called it a juggernaut of exaggeration, momentum, and thrills without a single lapse of subtlety. It's pure energy, a perfect orchestration of heroism, villainy, suspense, and comic relief. Ford makes the perfect writer for a project like this with his hand-dog, handsome everyman presence. He's one of us. But one of us at his personal best, and it's a great fun to ride along with him.
I like that. So
then here I've got one more. Entertainment Weekly says Ford may be the closest thing we have these days to Gary Cooper. How about that?
Well, and yet, again, a lot of diverse roles showing his depth as an actor. This one, and this one still resonates 20 plus years later as being one of his great roles, along with being Indiana Jones or being Han Solo or being Jack Ryan or some of the other movies that he's been in. This one's right there. So my point is, the critics liked it. Obviously, the box office was massive. The public likes it. And yet another thing that we talk about all the time is this movie is constantly on regular cable TV, especially on weekends, at night on weekends. That's how you know that this one still scores with the audiences, is because they know they'll stick it on a weekend and get some people, get tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands to watch and gravitate, because it's that big of a movie and that big of a deal.
Well, yeah, and as we speak, you know, it's on Cinemax right now. It's like, so if you have Cinemax on demand, whatever, you can jump on and watch it right after you finish listening to us. Or if you, you know, if you so see it, I'm sure you probably have it. I have it on DVD, so I can watch it, you know, on Blu-ray.
Right.
I can watch whenever I want.
But I mean,
it's
an AMC, a TNT, I mean, these different channels, they will put it on. They'll put it on and show it on a given weekend.
It's also one of those where it plays okay on commercial TV. It's better to watch it without the ads because it's so intense. You know, if you've got Harrison Ford is down in the basement of that Polish lady's house, and next thing you know, the cops are going to get him, and then you've got like a commercial for Wendy's or whatever. You know, it's not quite the same, but, you know, it's definitely one of those where it's a wonderful movie. And one thing I wanted to mention, just to kind of put in, you know, kind of show how big of a deal this was, because we always kind of wrap up with a little box office talk. On Harrison Ford, we've talked about all these huge movies he's in. His biggest movie ever, worldwide, unadjusted, is the most recent Star Wars he was in, where he was killed, Star Wars The Force Awakens, then Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, the Star Wars from 77, Indiana Jones The Last Crusade, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi, and then The Fugitive. It beat Raiders, it beat Temple of Doom, Air Force One, Blade Runner, Presumed Innocent, What Lies Beneath, Clear and Present Danger, and Patriot Games. So all these other just monumental blockbusters. It's ahead of all of them. It's like of Harrison Ford, who we mentioned, is the all-time biggest box office star. His total movies have grossed $8,918,000,000, and this is his seventh biggest movie.
And this is one, but it's still one of his signature ones that we all know.
Oh,
and it gives you an idea of how good he was that he has that many that were that successful besides that.
Absolutely.
All right. What
so
else?
Is there anything else we need to mention? What else? I've thrown all this stuff out. Anything you want to talk about?
I think we're good on the nuts and bolts of the movie. You mentioned they end up making the sequel, the U.S. Marshals sequel. We may do a We've Seen That on that. It came, 6 years later, 7 years later with Wesley Snipes as the accused, as the fugitive in this case. But Gerard and his team are back and are chasing him.
Robert Downey Jr. is also in it.
Yes.
It was released March 6th of 98, and it only grossed $57 million. It was not nearly as big a hit. And part of it, I think, was that Gerard was more humanized. You know, you met his ex-wife. You know, they're focused on him a lot more. You know, you don't focus nearly as much on Wesley Snipes. And, too, for whatever reason, Wesley Snipes' character turns out to be like a CIA guy or something. So he's not
correct.
He's not an everyman. He's more of a badass, too.
And but still, just, he's wrongfully accused, and he's running, and he's trying to prove his innocence. And it ends up that much the same way, the marshals help solve his case and help exonerate him in the end. A lot
and had
more
a good
action.
Cast. I think it would have been better if he was actually guilty. You know, because it's essentially a different version of the same story. You know, if they'd had him going after a bad guy and had him take him out at the end or something.
Yeah, but you got the twist where the marshals are in on it. One of the marshals is a bad guy, and a couple of the other higher-ups are bad guys. And so you had that twist in that as well. So corruption is still part of this. And
scale of 1 to 10, I would give The Fugitive a 9.5 or a 10. This is about the closest thing to a perfect movie that I've ever seen.
I'm with you.
I'd give U.S. Marshals about a 6.5 or 7.
Yeah, I would agree with both of those.
It's entertaining, and I love, you know, and like we talk about with a lot of the sequels we've done, is I like kind of seeing what these people are up to and kind of visiting the old friends. But a lot of times you're kind of like, oh, man, you know, it's all right. So, like I said, it's not something where I would tell people to avoid like the plague. But at the same time, I would say it's not. If you go into it with your expectations a tad tempered, you'll probably like it a little better. And one last question I actually have for you is, we've talked about this being a TV series twice. Could you imagine if they made a TV series version of this, like on Netflix now, where you could binge watch like a 10-hour version of this? And if they did, who would you have play any of these parts?
I don't know. I I'm so ingrained with Harrison Ford as Kimball and Tommy Lee Jones as Gerard. I don't know who else. Do you have somebody in mind? Again, as you mentioned, Michael T. Williamson played the Gerard character, and Tim Daly tried it as the fugitive there for a season and a half on CBS. You have somebody in mind that it would work if there was a third try?
You know, I literally, while we were talking, kind of just thought of this, so I haven't really given it a lot of thought. But off the top of my head, how about someone like maybe Matt Damon playing Dr. Kimball? Because he's a little bit
might
older. He can pull the everyday. If you take away the badass he was in Jason Bourne, most of his characters are pretty normal guys.
Who's the cop chasing him, though? I mean, that's where it equally works in this instance with Tommy Lee Jones. So who plays the cop?
If we're going to live in La La Land, I would make it Gene Hackman, because that means he would come back, and we hadn't seen him in like 10 years since Mooseport. Maybe Will Smith?
Maybe.
Will Smith could be a pretty good...
But of course, Will Smith is known so much more for Men in Black and being the cop in that and those other things. Bad Boys. He's a cop there too. So maybe.
But he also, he kind of played the guy that they were chasing, Enemy of the State. That was kind of like a modern version of The Fugitive in a way.
True.
Let me kind of vamp here for just a second. How about Michael Douglas? We talked about him a little bit earlier. How about him playing Gerard?
Now, Michael Douglas, but Michael Douglas in his day, because again, he's well.
Yeah,
past
Michael
the
Douglas
prime.
In his day of Basic Instinct, which another we've seen that classic when we did. How about even take it the other route? How about have Wesley Snipes play the Gerard? Because Wesley Snipes in Passenger 57 and Rising Sun, he's pretty good when he plays a cop.
Might
of course,
work.
We might see him playing Willie Mays Hayes, so we might expect him to, you know, drop down, do some push-ups too. I don't know. I think that'd be something interesting. We might can talk about that in a future episode. Maybe when we do U.S. Marshals, I have a little more time to think about it. Or if anyone else has any ideas on that, feel free to write us on our Facebook or our social media. We've seen that.
Might very well work. Again, you can find us on Twitter at We've Seen That, on Facebook and Instagram, as well as We've Seen That here for the show. All right. So
don't forget our catalog of shows is on iTunes and Stitcher. And please, please, please go rate us and review us and tell your friends about our show. We put a lot of time and effort into this because we know you guys love listening to it. We hear y'all's feedback and everything. And by all means, subscribe to it. That way, you know, you'll get a notification on your phone as soon as we have a new episode up. And speaking of episodes, we've got a few coming up that we're already working on. We have Days of Thunder with Tom Cruise. We're going to do that around the Daytona 500. We have Groundhog Day starring Bill Murray. We're going to do that coincidentally around Groundhog Day. And with the Winter Olympics coming up, we've got a couple of surprises. We're going to do Cool Runnings and Miracle. You looking forward to those, TJ?
So I'm looking forward to the Olympics that are upcoming at the time we're talking, and we're in the winter time. As you mentioned, it's freezing cold there, so we'll have fun with that. But NASCAR will be here in Florida before we know it, so the Days of Thunder part will be exciting. So, yeah, we're going to have a lot of fun with a lot of different shows as we head towards the first part of the year at the time we're talking right now. Again, we encourage the audience that you can go back and listen to our catalog of other shows, whether it's Die Hard, Presumed Innocent will probably be one that we do somewhere down the road that's a Harrison Ford one. This is the first one we've done on that, but we've done Bruce Willis. We've done Michael Douglas in Basic Instinct. On and on down, Christmas Vacation, laughing along with Chevy Chase and company, the Star Wars movies. Eddie Murphy, we laugh with him in Beverly Hills Cop 2. Go back and listen to the catalog of shows through our friends at Blog Talk Radio, or if you're subscribing via iTunes and Stitcher. So we just encourage the audience to come be part of it. And we had fun dissecting The Fugitive, and what a great movie, and what a I'm ready to go watch it again and check out some of the things that you've pointed out, too, about the movie, and go see it again.
By all means. It's one of those where you can just pick it up at any time if you've seen it in the past, because, like I said, it's kind of like you're visiting your old friends and just watching the camaraderie amongst the marshals. You know, it's such a great movie, and I highly recommend it to everybody.
All right. Good stuff. Famous Jay, you had fun?
I had fun. I feel like I need to go get some glass of water or something because I've been talking for so long.
Well, but we've had a blast talking about The Fugitive. It's a great movie. It's a classic movie. Again, look on regular cable. It'll also be available on Netflix and online, and sometimes on premium cable. They'll be running the replays. A classic time period in the early 90s when Harrison Ford and Tommy Lee Jones were both red hot as actors. Great stuff with The Fugitive. Famous Jay, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks. See you, everybody.
There is The Famous Jay. Follow him at The Famous Jay on Twitter. Follow this show at We've Seen That on social media, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. We'll come back with another edition of our little digital radio show. Spread the word via iTunes, Stitcher, etc. Hear about what we do from the movies of the 80s and 90s and more on We've Seen That. I'm TJ Reeves for The Famous Jay Betzel. Thanks for being with us on this edition for The Fugitive.